Hi there. Welcome to the Agency Toolkit Podcast, a podcast where we discuss stories, strategies, and techniques to help you build a successful and profitable digital marketing agency. Our episodes contain inspiring conversations with CEOs and entrepreneurs and leave you with actionable tips, ideas, and strategies you can implement into your business today. We are happy to have you with us. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and get inspired.
Hey, Julia here. If you'd like to grow your agency with a new free traffic source, we've put together a free resource for you called the Agency Traffic Blueprint, which outlines how you can acquire free organic traffic for your agency's website using Powered by Marketing. You can get that at getrubyrobin.com/blueprint or check the description of this episode for the link.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into another episode of the Agency Toolkit. I am your host, Julia McLaughlin. My guest today is Adam Stoker, who is the president and CEO of Relic. He graduated from Brigham Young University's nationally ranked advertising program and has been working in advertising for 15 years. Today, we're going to be discussing Adam's journey of building his agency and what he's learned along the way. So thank you so much for joining us today, Adam.
Yeah, Julia, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. So to get started, let's dive into a couple of questions so our listeners can get to know you a little bit.
Great.
So what would you say really motivates or inspires you as an entrepreneur?
You know, this is one that's, I feel like there's 500 answers to this that I could give. But you know, I've got a young family. I've got four kids, 11 or under, and I've got an amazing wife. And you know, first and foremost, it's I want to provide a good life and good living for my family.
Yeah.
But the other thing is I've learned that I'm never really satisfied with where I'm at. And so I kind of feel this constant drive to get better and improve. And so I think for, and you can probably relate to this as an entrepreneur, that innate desire to constantly be improving means that you're never satisfied with what you're doing and you want more. And it's not about more money or more notoriety, but it's more accomplishment. And I just don't know how to do that without being in control of the business that I'm working in. And so yes. I think that also drives me to continue to push for success as an entrepreneur.
Yes. It's hard to put into words, but it's just something that really you're just attracted to. You have to build and create as an entrepreneur. And like you said, you've got that constant urge for, you know, what's next. Like you're never really satisfied. Yep. You know, you reach that goal and then you're just like, all right, what's the next goal I can tackle?
Absolutely.
So how did you get into digital marketing?
Well, so this is going to be a little bit of a long story, but I went to Brigham Young University, and it's funny because I was in school from 06 to 09, which, you know, right before the big recession of 2008. And so during that time, I really didn't have a lot of urgency as a student to figure out what I was going to do. And so I took a lot of intro classes. I took intro to PR, and you know, PR theory didn't really get me excited. And I personally think they should probably do less theory and a little bit more tactical education in that first class so that people don't get bored. But then I took print journalism, and I actually thought I wanted to be a journalist. My dad was a journalist and then okay. Eventually became a college professor. And so I thought that might be interesting to kind of follow in his footsteps. And during that time, I actually met my wife, and it was very clear to me the moment I met her that like, this was it. I was never going to find better than her, you know? And so as we were dating, we talked about getting a little more serious, and she said, well, I got to have some idea of what you're going to do with your life if I'm going to marry you. And so I said, okay. And the next semester I took intro to advertising. And so it was the combination of the urgency to understand what the future looked like.
Yeah.
And falling in love with that intro to advertising class that led me to say, okay, this is where I want to go.
Oh, I love that. You know, I was the same in a way. I fell in love with advertising. I went to college for advertising, but all through high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I took one marketing class and absolutely loved it. And then, you know, when I was picking all the colleges where I was going to go, I did an intro to advertising. And yeah, same thing, just fell in love with it. And yeah, it was. I feel like it was the first time that I really enjoyed school.
Yeah, you know, there was something about the creative, and we talked about how, you know, I'm a builder, I want to build. And with clients and campaigns, you can actually build something meaningful every single time. And so every project where we got the ability to try something out or build a campaign for a potential client and do that kind of tactical practice, I just loved it. I loved every second of it. And to be honest with you, as a mediocre student up to that point, there was very little that I got excited about before that class.
Yeah, no, same. And when you're able to use, you know, both sides of your brain, you're able to, you know, combine that creative with that strategic side of your brain as well. I think that's where the magic can happen for a lot of people.
Absolutely. So went to BYU, took the intro to advertising class, fell in love with it, applied and got into the BYU advertising program. And I graduated in August of 2009. And August of 2009, in the last 15 to 18 years, maybe the absolute worst time to try to break into advertising. I had worked at a small agency while I was in school, a little digital agency, and gained a lot of experience and understanding of the industry, things like that. But then when I graduated and went to look for a job, that little agency went out of business 3 weeks before I graduated. Ooh. And so I'm sitting here thinking, I thought I had it all figured out. You know, I knew what I was going to do. And then I was kind of flailing, trying to find something else. In August of 2009, I went to every agency in the Salt Lake area and tried to break in. I leaned on connections and got meetings with some agency owners, but was unable to find a job, and finally got an offer at a little agency, or well, I shouldn't say a little agency. It's an agency of, I think, 400 people in Farmington, Utah, called Thomas Arts. Mm-hmm. And it was just an internship for $10 an hour. And me, with my inflated ego, I felt like I was worth way more than that. And it was really hard to take the internship. In fact, I had an offer to leave the advertising industry for, I think, $40,000-$50,000 a year compared to that $10 an hour internship. Yeah. And I think one of the best decisions I've ever made is taking that $10 an hour internship. And I learned in the next year and a half so much about just advertising. And I learned what school didn't prepare me for. Yes. You know, we're doing everything in a vacuum in school, but then mm-hmm. when you get client feedback, it all goes out the window, right? And, yeah. And so I got a lot of tactical practice there at Thomas Arts. And it was really there that I decided this is where I'm going to build a career. And after a year and a half, I kind of realized, there was a group of, the agency was small in that it was a family owned business. I shouldn't say family owned, the owner owned it, but then his family was all kind of employed there. Right. And then he had like close friends that also worked there. And I realized that there was kind of and this wasn't intentional by any means by them, but there was kind of the inner circle and the outer circle. And I did not feel like a part of the inner circle. And so I realized I probably needed to move on. So I was considering going to grad school and going to Virginia Commonwealth University's Brand Center. And I had my application in with the exception of just a video that I needed to create. And I saw a job posting for a little advertising agency in St. George, Utah, which was about 4 hours away from where I lived. Mm-hmm. And it was a community that I really liked and thought might be a fun place to live. And so I applied, and the next day I went down and met with the owner, and we really hit it off, and he convinced me to move down to St. George, Utah and start working there as an account manager, and also with the responsibility to bring in new accounts and then build kind of the infrastructure to manage those accounts as I went. Really great opportunity for somebody a year and a half into their career.
Of course. Yeah, that's amazing. And then when did you decide to start Relic? What was your, you know, your deciding factor to go out on your own and start your own agency?
Yeah. So I worked at that it was called Sorenson Advertising at the time. And I worked there for about 5 years. And after 5 years, we had actually had a hard time recruiting to St. George. And so we opened up a Provo office of Sorenson Advertising. And the owner was kind of complaining to me about, you know, what a pain it was to commute between both offices and try to take care of everybody. And I just said, you know, have you ever thought about selling this thing? And he's like, well, yeah, I have. I said, how about to me? You know, and the crazy thing was, I had no idea what it takes to buy a business. And I actually think the theme of my career is, thank goodness for my ignorance, because had I known what it takes to try to buy a business, I don't know if I would have done it, but I just assumed I could walk into a bank and get a loan and convince them to fund me buying a business. And that began a process of really about 6 months of trying to wrangle, because I didn't have any money, you know, and trying to wrangle enough money to be able to buy the agency. And so I got a friend of mine from high school that had a pretty solid nest egg that lent me the money for the down payment on the loan. Wow. I went to several banks and you know, laughed out of the room in a lot of the situations, but got one bank to say, okay, yeah, we'll do it. And here's the rate, and was able to buy the business outright. And, you know, as an employee, I thought, oh, I think he's doing so many things that I could do better. And I don't like what he does here. Don't like what he does there. And then, you know, I get in the role and it's like, holy cow, I understand so many of the things that may have bothered me as an employee, but yeah, make a lot of sense as an owner. And so it was me and the guy that helped me with the down payment. And then the person that I had teamed up with to really create all the campaigns that we worked together on, his name's Colby Raymond. He's my business partner. And we said, hey, let's do it, you know. And we bought the business, and it's been difficult and challenging and wonderful and incredible and everything in between.
Yeah, that's so cool. I love that story. And so how do you continue to grow the agency and bring in more leads and, you know, close those prospects as well?
Yeah, so that's proven to be something that took a long time for us to kind of figure out. Mm-hmm. When it was just me calling and pounding the pavement and bringing in business, I was pretty good at that and I thought it was something that I could, I'm going to use a word here that's not a word, but I use it from time to time, systematize or processify. I thought it was something that I could do, when in reality, I think, and there's a lot of skills that I don't have. So I want to make sure that I'm not just making it sound like I had this amazing skill to bring in business. There's a lot that I don't know how to do, but that's a skill that I had. I could go sit down with somebody, understand their needs, and make a solid recommendation of how to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. Teaching that to a hired salesperson was much more difficult than I anticipated.
Yes.
And we've gone through a few different salespeople. But ultimately what I decided to do is I said, you know what? I need a place. Excuse me. I need a place where I can have the credibility that we know what we're talking about. And that really came when I tried to grow the agency outside of Utah. And I guess I ought to give a little context here. In 2012, we brought on our first tourism destination. It was Cedar City Bryanhead Tourism Bureau in Cedar City, Utah. And when we brought them on, we our eyes were opened into this industry of destination marketing. And it was like, this is fun. It's amazing. They pay their bills. Like there's so many good things about the industry.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, referral after referral, it's 40% of our business. And so I was under the impression that we could just continue to scale that trajectory in tourism. But what I found is, as I got outside of Utah, lots of other agencies say they know how to do destination marketing as well. So how do you stand out? So yes. I started a podcast in 2019 called the Destination Marketing Podcast. And that podcast has actually snowballed and become as far as I'm aware, and I've talked to a lot of different people in the industry and a lot of different podcasters in the industry, as far as I'm aware, it's the most listened to podcast in the industry. I'm only targeting destination marketers, which means people that have been hired to market a tourism destination in their area.
Yeah.
And so there's only about 10,000 of them in the United States. And my podcast just hit 70,000 listens last week. And so the market penetration for that podcast has been really good. And through creating that podcast and then going to conferences and recording in-person episodes at those conferences, it's created, for one, the credibility that I was looking for. But for two, I get a fair amount of inbound conversations from people that have listened to my show, have read my book, because I used the podcast and curated the content from the podcast into a book on how to evaluate and enhance your brand as mm-hmm. a tourism destination. And so I've gotten some inbound inquiries and requests from that. And I can attribute almost all of the clients we've picked up in the last 2 years, I can attribute it back to that podcast that I started in 2019.
Wow, that's so interesting. Very cool. And then, so what is the key to maintaining happy clients who are going to help bring in those referrals at the end of the day?
You know, that's what makes the agency business such a challenging business to own, manage, and run. It's a service business. And mm-hmm. the more you grow, and I've learned this, the more you grow, the less control you have over the quality of work that's being done by each individual employee. And the longer it takes to diagnose problems that you have in your employee base. And we've got amazing employees. We've had amazing employees over the year, but just like any organization at any given time, there might be somebody that's going through a hard time or somebody that's struggling or just has kind of also lost interest, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if you can't diagnose that quickly, it's very challenging. And so how do I keep clients happy? That's a question I'm trying to answer every single day, because, you know, as an agency owner, I'm sure other agency owners feel this way. When you plug one hole in the dam, two more open up and you're trying to solve that problem too.
Yeah.
I also, in 2020, there was an agency owner here in Utah that I knew that was kind of looking to move on from his agency. And so I actually purchased his agency as well with mm-hmm. my partners. And so now we have the two organizations. One is Relic, that's focused entirely on tourism. Mm-hmm. And then one is EKR, and EKR is focused on non-tourism organizations. And so we work with, you know, there's a major cookie company. I don't know if you've seen the Utah Cookie Wars stuff going on LinkedIn, but it's Dirty Dough versus Crumble, and it's a heavyweight bout, and we're representing Dirty Dough, which is the challenger in the cookie war. And we've got some really, really fun campaigns that we're working on the EKR side. And the reason I bring that up is doing great work makes clients happy. And
yes.
And the thing that we've really tried to focus on in our organization, especially over the last year, is yes, we can be more organized. Yes, we can have better processes, and we've worked on all that. But the thing that's moved the needle the most for our clients is doing great work, not good work, great work. And
great
when
work.
We've done great work, and there's a lot of ways to define great work, but I define it by the reaction of the client.
Mm-hmm.
when it's amazing and the client is blown away and you start to get referrals more and more, it's clear that you've done great work. And I think that the focus on doing great work for our clients over the last year and a half has really paid off and helped our clients be much happier.
When you're creating that great work for your clients, would you say that's a combination of, you know, managing those expectations with them and then also exceeding those expectations?
You know, it's funny. I think what I would attribute the great work to is clients hire us. They think they hire us because of our services. So when I say services, digital ad buying, SEO, creative, you know, all the different things. They hire us for those services, but they also can get those services. Agency work has become so commoditized, right? There's so much competition in the space. Yeah. And I've got 40 minutes of content I could give you on my opinion on what's happened in the agency space, whatever, but we won't do that today. But what they can't get anywhere else is the best ideas that your organization can come up with as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so while I think all the different things that we offer are great, it's our ideas that make us indispensable, and it's our ideas that lead to great work. And so the focus on ideation as opposed to execution, that's been a transition that's really helped us to move that needle. And the quality of ideas is what I feel like has improved our client satisfaction in the last year, year and a half.
Interesting. Okay. I like that. Very cool. So what would you say has been the biggest overall challenge that you've had to overcome as you've been growing Relic?
Oh man. And any agency owner that's listening knows this. I mean, there's a lot of challenges that come along with running an agency.
Yeah.
I think for me, the biggest challenge has been that I am who I am, and I've got kind of my own personality. And I think understanding how other people interpret the things that I say and preparing for that is the place where I've had to grow the most as a leader, because the way I want to receive feedback is not equal to the way my employees want to receive feedback. So there's That's been huge. Many, many times that I've tried to give constructive feedback to an employee in an effort to help them reach their goals, which mm-hmm. in turn will help us as an organization reach our goals. Mm-hmm. And the way it's interpreted is not the way it's intended. And I'm still trying to get better at that. It's my biggest challenge is my learning this. I mean, I bought this thing while it was going, right? It's not like I'm building from scratch and doing from the ground up. Yep. So many things that other people that have built from the ground up that they would have figured out by now, mm-hmm. I'm still learning. And I think the biggest challenge has been my inadequacies in managing people, because I had to learn it on the fly, just like I'm asking them to do. You know, so there, if I've got a new digital marketer and the digital marketer needs to do a better job of placing the ads and evaluating and reporting and all that kind of stuff, what they don't necessarily realize is that I'm learning in my role what I need to do better. And the only way to learn that is to make mistakes and learn from them. And I've made a lot of mistakes in that category.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. And it's so true. Everyone's different. Some people prefer like blunt feedback and, you know, they don't take it personal and, you know, they see it for what it is. And others, you know, you need to sugarcoat it a little bit. So I think there's something to really, you know, having that conversation with your team and just talking about, you know, like what ways do you like to receive feedback, and so that it's, you know, most helpful to them.
Well, and sometimes you'll ask that question and they may say one thing but mean another, right? Like some people say, oh yeah, give it to me, I can handle it, because I've had this before. It's like, okay, here's what I see that I need you to improve on, and here's when I need it to happen. And then they're like, I can't believe you said that to me. And so like, there's one thing how they say they want to receive feedback, but you have to observe in each interaction how it's received mm-hmm. and make changes based on how they receive it as opposed to how they say they want to receive it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a difficult thing for sure. It's definitely a balancing act, and you've got to really kind of use your gut feel when you're communicating that feedback.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. So where do you see Relic in 5 years' time?
Well, I mean, if you had asked me that question 5 years ago, I would have been so wrong about where it would be today, you know? And so I think that's one thing that gets really challenging for me as someone who likes to look into the future and have a vision. it's difficult sometimes to have it not go the way you planned. I mean, none of us planned for COVID 5 years ago, right?
No.
And that's just one example. Where do I see us going in 5 years, though? There's a couple things that I think are really interesting that we're doing that I think is facilitating a lot of growth. So the first one I'll say is with EKR, we've got this cookie franchise that we've really been able to help go from zero to 100. And you know, I can't define what 100 is right now, but they went from zero to selling 150 franchises, for example, in about 40 days.
Wow, that's incredible.
It was amazing. And by the way, so much of this is them, right? Like they were doing so many things right. Their timing was right. Their model's great. It's set up great for franchisees. But the marketing campaign that we built as part of the process, and we built their brand, you know, when they came to us, we had to kind of break down and rebuild their brand from the ground up. Mm-hmm. And so we started there and then built their marketing plan. And then there's a variety of things that happened that led to a lot of public recognition for this Utah Cookie Wars campaign. And, you know, what's happened is we've had a few organizations that are franchise organizations reach out to us. We just signed another one in another industry that came to us specifically because of the work that we had done for this cookie franchising company. And so the reason I bring that up, I think we're going to do a lot more work in the national franchising space with a variety of organizations, because it seems like there's a lot of momentum there for us right now.
Exciting.
So on the EKR side, that's what I see. On the Relic side, it's interesting. We've developed a product that nobody else had done in the tourism industry. And that's that because of my podcast, I kept getting people asking me, well, can you help us start a podcast? And so my answer on the first several was kind of, no, we're an agency. That's not really what we do.
Yeah.
But now we've built the only podcast network in the tourism industry. We have over 20 podcasts that our team produces and facilitates for our clients.
Oh, wow.
And that is where we have an incredible amount of momentum. And the reason is, you know, there's lots of agencies in the tourism space, but there's not a lot of agencies in the tourism space doing podcasts. So what we're doing is we're bringing on those podcasts and then leveraging that podcast relationship to expand the relationship with agency work as, you know, as it grows, as the relationship grows and they trust us more.
Yep.
And I think in 5 years, we may have 150 destination podcasts under our belt that we're working on and managing. And I think we will have changed the tourism industry forever by helping tourism destinations understand the value of owned media like podcasts.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. So you're kind of using podcasting as a foot in the door strategy, and then it just opens up that conversation for doing their other marketing efforts as well.
You got it. And we've opened the industry's eyes in a lot of cases to the value of owned media. And that's creating so many opportunities for us right now.
Yeah, that's so exciting. Very cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
So we are getting ready to move on to the Fast Five. So I'll have five rapid fire questions for you in just a moment. But do you have any, you know, final thoughts or words of wisdom that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I just would say that, and I'm assuming that listeners are going to be other agency owners or aspiring
That's right.
agency owners.
Yep.
And I think what I would say is, like you asked me the question, what does the next 5 years look like? I think you can bang your head against the wall and try to plan for the future and know exactly what it's going to look like. But the place where you're going to find success is in the small pivots that happen as a reaction to circumstances or market conditions. And that's actually where you identify the opportunities that are going to lead to your most growth. Mm-hmm. And so you just have to be prepared in difficult situations to pivot and not be so married to your vision that when everything is telling you that your vision isn't right, that not to just stick with it just because that's what you believed 5 years ago, because you have to evolve. You have to be able to recognize opportunities and then lean into those opportunities and be willing to change your business accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really great advice. Yeah. And then, you know, also putting in, I just had this conversation about, you know, putting in place those daily habits so that, you know, you're always looking through the lens of, you know, either putting those boundaries in place, knowing when to say no, that sort of thing, that's going to help, that's going to be in line with where you want to be headed as well. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So, all right, well, we're ready to move on to the fast five now. So
I'm in.
What's a book you've read that's made an impact on you?
You know, I've read lots of books that I think have made an impact on me, but I really struggle with a lot of these business books that people recommend, because in every single one of them, you can read the first chapter and understand what it's going to be about. And then the whole rest of the book, in most cases, is a waste of time where the author's arguing that their hypothesis is correct. And so
it's just repetitive.
Yes, it's just like example after example, highlighting the same thing. And so I always get about halfway through those books and abandon them. Mm-hmm. The books that really hold my attention are biographies of people that have been great. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean they've been great people in every single case, right?
Yep.
I've read some books about people that really disappointed me with their moral. So for example, I read Anthony Kiedis's book from Red Hot Chili Peppers, and the entire thing was basically just a love letter to drugs. And you know, I wanted to hear his story, and anyway, it wasn't really what I was hoping for. But one that has, in my mind, has educated me so much it's a book by Jeff Benedict called Tiger, and it's the biography of Tiger Woods. Mm. And it goes from prior to his birth and the situation with his parents all the way through his career. And what it taught me is, what is the cost of greatness? Mm-hmm. And the reason I look at it that way is a couple of reasons. One is, there's a few key things in that book that his father did that guaranteed that he would be great at golf, right? There was a lot of repetition, for example, and I think repetition is a very important component of becoming great. Mm-hmm. I think there was also really hard parenting and mm-hmm. leadership. And what I mean by hard is, like, he wasn't allowed to be soft, right? And while that strengthened him, there's also a cost of greatness that made other things really challenging for him in life, like the relationships that he had in life, right? And so what I actually have tried to do from that book, from what I read in that book, is I want to make sure that in my effort to be great, I'm not having to pay the cost of greatness by overdoing it in one category, because I also mm-hmm. want to be a great father. I also yes. want to be a great husband. I also want to be a great person, right?
Yep.
And so I can't define my success by the greatness in my career that I aspire to. Mm-hmm. I have to make sure that it's balanced greatness across the board. And boy, do I fail all the time at it, but that's my goal.
Yeah, I agree. It can definitely be challenging, but I'm with you there. I think it's, you know, you've got those big ambitions and those big goals you want to work towards, but at the same time, you know, you're a good person and you don't want to, you know, also regret missing out on time with your family and, you know, your wife and your children down the road as well.
Exactly. And that's why that book was so helpful, to see what the cost of greatness is. If you go all in on one component of your life, mm-hmm. there's a cost to that. And I think Tiger Woods, unfortunately, has had to pay the cost of that. And I would rather be really good in all aspects of my life than really great in one and bad at everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's it. That's a really great point. I love that. Awesome. So what is your favorite online tool?
Well, there's a couple of things that I use. It's hard to pick something that's my favorite online tool. Something that has helped me a lot to organize myself, which is not one of my inherent gifts, is organization is not one of them. Trello is a great online platform to help keep me on top of my tasks and know what needs to be done. Haven't done as good of a job in the last month or so of keeping up with it, but it really has helped me kind of organize my to-do list and make sure things don't fall through the cracks. The other one is Evernote. I really like Evernote because I can take notes in a conversation and access those notes across whatever device that I'm on. And I know there's other tools that'll do that, but that seemed to be the one that kind of works really well for me.
Very good. And what does your morning routine look like?
So it's actually changed over the last year. I've never really been a morning person, and I've really tried to make an effort to focus. You know, once your doctor tells you you've got high blood pressure, you really realize that you probably need to start changing a couple of things.
Yeah.
And so I've tried to change my morning routine in the last year. I get up between 6 and 6:30, and I exercise, whether that's when it's warm outside and light outside. My wife and I will actually go for a run or a walk for 30, 45 minutes. And then we'll come back and I help her get the kids ready for school. Sometimes I'll drive them to school if I'm working from home, or I'll head to the office. And then I'm ready to kind of start work and kind of have all the other things that I needed to check off the box out of the way by the time I start work. So it's exercise, hang with the kids, help them get ready, and then head to work.
Awesome. And you may have already sort of answered this question, but is there a CEO that you follow or study?
I'll tell you, there's a group of CEOs or entrepreneurs that I've discovered in the last 4 to 6 months. And it's the guys that host the All In podcast. There's several Silicon Valley, they might not be CEOs right now, but they've been CEOs in the past. I think they're all billionaires. If not, they're close to it. Mm-hmm. And they discuss business, they discuss politics, they discuss current events and how they think about it. Because what I've learned from them is when you see what's happening in the world, you draw conclusions that help you be prepared in your business or personally. And understanding how they're thinking about it has helped me understand how to think about it as it pertains to my organization. And so that podcast has become a must listen for me. And I really admire those guys and the insight that they bring to every situation that they discuss.
Very cool. Definitely have to check that out. The All In podcast.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It's great.
And last question, what's one thing you wish you had known when you began your career?
You know, that's a hard one. And I might go back to harp on something that I said a little bit earlier. And that's that don't try to plan everything out, because at the beginning of my career, I had so many things early on in my career that just felt devastating, right? The agency I was working for went out of business. I couldn't get a job and I had to take an internship when I thought I should be making $50,000 a year. And I had several failures early on in my career. And I remember crying, bawling my eyes out when a manager of mine that I looked up to left the organization I was working for. And I look back on that and I'm like, if I had just understood how valuable each of those painful experiences were to who I am today and the failures I have today, I'm sure are going to be incredibly valuable for who I'm supposed to become. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had understood, I wish I had had a long-term perspective on failures and mistakes mm-hmm. when I started my career, because I don't think I would have been so hard on myself.
Yes. Yes. It's such a good point. A lot of us lack the ability to really take a step back and just know that every experience along the way is helping shape where you're headed. So yeah, I think that's really great insight.
Yeah, well, I'll just respond to that on one more thing. I've been teaching each of my kids how to ride their bike. And when they trip or, you know, fall down, skin their elbow, whatever it is on their bike, I say, hey, I don't care if you fall down, you have to get back up. What do we do when we fall down? And they have to repeat back to me, we get back up. I'm like, yes. And yet I don't look at my career that way. You know, it's so hard to take, because learning in your career is like learning to ride a bike. You're going to fall down, you're going to screw up, and then with a little bit of practice, you're going to get there. And it's easy to look at on a small thing like riding a bike, but so hard to apply to your career.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. Well, that's a really great thing to instill into your children though. You know, the idea of just, you know, just got to keep going. Don't give up. So I love that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Adam. It was a real pleasure to learn about your journey as an entrepreneur and, you know, learn about your story with starting Relic. So thank you again for joining me for today's episode.
Thanks, Julie. I appreciate it. It's fun to be on the guest side of the microphone. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Agency Toolkit. We hope you've learned something new that you can implement into your agency today. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to our podcast, and we'll see you next time.